Welcome to the Pick Place Podcast, a show where we talk about electronics manufacturing and everything related to getting a circuit board into the world. This is Chris Denny with Worthington.
And this is Melissa Hogue with Circuit Hub.
Welcome back, Melissa.
Welcome back, Chris, finally.
Fresh off of our world-famous YouTube video of impedance control.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're going to be right up there with Casey Neistat. Mr. Beast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we have gotten more views than I thought we would already, and some comments. So thank you very much for everyone who has watched that.
And I wonder if they took my request seriously and smashed the like button. Hopefully they didn't break their devices when they smashed it.
Oh, man.
You remember that was a thing for a while. Like everybody said smash
the
like button.
Make sure to smash that like button.
Yeah. But now it's not smash anymore. I forget what they say now. It's not the smash anymore.
I don't know. I haven't had enough time to watch enough YouTube videos to know.
Yeah.
So speaking of fresh off of things, you are fresh off your trip to Chicago where you visited Omron and Fuji.
Omron. I think they're probably both acceptable, correct ways of pronouncing it. Good suppliers of ours, very happy with their equipment. They happen to be about 30 minutes from each other. Fuji was doing an open house and went out to visit those guys. There's a bunch of people there, over 100 customers, tons of employees, really neat stuff they're working on, like totally autonomous machine changeovers. So the stencil printer, the solder paste inspection machine, pick and place machines, the reflow oven, the AOI, everything changes itself over. So there's actually like a unit that will load and unload the stencil automatically built into the stencil printer. There's like this little robot on the front of the pick and place machines on a little like railroad. It's the best way I could describe it, that loads and unloads the feeders from the pick and place machines. So like when you do a changeover, it automatically switches out the feeders it no longer needs and puts in the feeders that it needs. And oh, it was really wild. I'd never seen anything like it, but yeah, so they were showing all that off, and I had never been. We've bought a bunch of Omron inspection equipment. I've never actually been there, and I was like, "Well, if I'm going out for this open house, and these guys are only 30 minutes from each other, may as well pay a visit." It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Their building, both of their buildings are beautiful. It's actually Omron's U.S. headquarters, so not just their AOI division, but like their relays and their safety instruments and their robots and everything. So it's like this huge, huge building. Yeah, it was really nice, but I'm tired. It was
a jam-packed trip.
Yeah, it was jam-packed. It was just for one day. I flew out that morning and then we had dinner and then I flew home the next morning. But it was, learned a lot, met a lot of cool people, and yeah, it was good. It was like a mini trade show almost, but just for Fuji.
Nice.
Yeah. Some well-known businesses there. I'll leave it at that. Some very, some engineers from some well-known consumer brands, customers, actually. Oh, okay. It's funny how many companies that we build for that actually have Fuji pick and place equipment. You know, it's like, oh, why do we build boards for you if you, but they do the production and we do their prototypes and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It was good. It's a good trip. But this week, what are we talking about this week, Melissa?
We're answering some of your questions.
Finally. I've been wanting to do this forever. Yeah, not my questions.
We'll get very tangential.
Yeah, very quick. Very meta. Yeah, so we had an awesome response. The first time I asked for questions, we had a bunch of suggestions for show topics. A bunch of them we're going to make a dedicated show for, but some of them I thought could fit into a grab bag. So this week it's a grab bag of answering questions. And actually, I think all the questions we have in this week's episode are all from one person, one listener. A listener named Sarah wrote in a bunch of questions, and some of them I do want to do, we can do a whole dedicated show for. So we got those lined up and we're actually looking for some like special guests to talk about just that. Like just these one topics, some of the questions that she proposed, but some of the other ones I figured to be quick and we'll do a grab bag episode. So that's what we got today.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. If you're out there listening, we appreciate all of your questions.
And thank you, Melissa, for properly pronouncing her name, because I'm incapable of pronouncing Sarah's name. My wife's correct. Yes. You somehow are able to put the E in there, and I always put it, like, roll an A into it.
What?
Yeah.
Sarah? Like, Sarah?
So, see, somebody near and dear to my heart, my wife, tells me that I pronounce Sarah wrong.
Sarah. Sarah.
And same thing with a woman named Erin and a man named Aaron.
Aaron.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently I'm incapable of pronouncing those two.
I probably pronounce it like the Southern California girl.
That must be it. That must be
Sarah.
It.
Sarah.
Omron or Omron. So let's have it, Melissa.
All right. To get us started, let's see. What do we have here? Would you provide the yield of a specific batch or design to the customer? I think this is a valuable KPI to make informed decision. And is the yield of the bare board PCB available to the CM? The reason I'm asking this is because I'm trying to get this information from my current supplier, and some of them are really reluctant to provide this, and others say that they don't know the yield at the bare PCB level.
That's a great question. Yeah, so our yield is, we don't know our yield because we're not usually doing testing. In a production environment, for sure, we would track the yield. But usually, see, on an assembly level, you're usually able to get, in a production environment, you're usually able to get up to 100%. Like, you're usually able to figure out why something failed. It's pretty unusual that you don't. Maybe after a certain amount of time, you just write that board off as not passing a test. But usually you can get up to 100% yield. Now I say 100%, but I'm talking sub 1,000 boards. You know, we're not talking tens of thousands here. From the bare board manufacturer, they don't generally give us those yields. I've never really requested them, but I guarantee you they have it, because they'll come back to us sometimes and they'll tell us, hey, you know, we really struggled on this board because of XYZ, and the design was very challenging and we had to scrap a lot of boards. Can you, you know, talk to your customer about making some small changes here and there that would improve things? So for example, we had one customer that was doing 6 mil traces and gaps between traces, 6 mil, but they needed 2 ounce copper. And that's very difficult to do with 6 mil tracking gap or tracing gap. So they said, hey, could you do 8 or even 10? Like, could you ask your customer if that was possible to do a redesign? Because we really struggled to get the yield up. So we have seen it before. I think that was a particularly rough situation for our supplier. So they reached out to us about that. But yeah, I'm confident you could get it from them. You might not be able to get it posthumously. Is that the right phrase? Posthumously?
Posthumously?
Yeah, it's the right phrase for when somebody dies, but I'm not sure it's the right phrase for after an order has been fulfilled.
After the order is dead.
Yeah, you know, like, you know, let's say Tom Petty got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame posthumously. Actually, I think he was inducted in before he was passed on from this earth, but that's the phrase you use for that kind of situation. I'm not sure if you use that for after a board is shipped, but if you ask for it ahead of time, I'm sure you can get it. You can ask them, you know, if you shipped us 1,000, how many did you have to scrap to get to 1,000? I'm confident that a bare board manufacturer could get you that information. From a contract manufacturer's level, from the assembly level, the yield number, it depends. If we're building prototypes for somebody, we're only building 50 boards or something like that, or the yield's going to be 50 for 50. That's what we're aiming for. We're probably not going to measure the yield. But if you ask us if there was any assembly issues, you know, we'll be able to provide some feedback and say, yeah, you know, we struggled with this and this is how we worked around it. And a lot of times we're proactive about that too. So we'll tell you like what we struggled with, and we'd ask if you could, you know, make room for improvement in your design in the future. Or, you know, hey, we got by on this order. We only built 5 pieces, but if you plan on ordering more than 5 pieces in the future, we really need to get custom tools made to hold things or blah, 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 blah. So yeah, Melissa, the answer to this question is going to be like our other questions. Yeah. Have a conversation. But if you have that conversation ahead of time and you say, you know, hey, we're trying to chase down some issues here. Could you tell us what your yields are? Or could you tell us, you know, what you're struggling with? And I'm confident any CM would be able to work with you on that. And the bare board supplier, I'm confident they would. After you've received the order and you're struggling, would they have that information? Not necessarily. They may not have, you know, if they weren't asked to track that information ahead of time, they may not have it after they've shipped the order, but yeah, they might. It's possible. Depends on their process and, you know, what their focus is on, I guess. So hopefully that answers that question.
Okay. So next, what happens to the excess parts? When you buy parts normally, there is a buffer or percent excess. If it isn't used, what happens to it?
Yeah, so we call this buying with attrition or with attrition in mind. So if we're going to build 100 boards for somebody and you have a really expensive QFN or whatever, we're going to order 102 or 103 of those QFNs. If you if it's just a cheap 10K resistor, we're probably going to order an entire reel or at least, you know, like 200 of them. You know, or, you know, whatever. We're going to order tons of extra because the extra is going to be like 50 cents. It's it's like not even going to matter. In that case, it's scrapped. We have a recycler that comes and takes our electronics because there's a lot of good, there's a lot of gold in them, silver, valuable materials, and they like that stuff. So usually it gets scrapped if there's just, you know, so if we bought 103 QFNs, we needed 101 of them, two are left over, that's going to get scrapped. Yeah, that's the reality. If we buy an enormous excess of something quite expensive, we might hold it, especially if we expect that you'll place a subsequent order. But that's pretty unusual. And usually that's like a conversation's taking place ahead of time. You know, you're coming to us and you're saying, hey, this expensive connector, we got a good deal worked out with Samtech. Buy from them, buy 1,000 of them and hold them. We'll have you build 100, but then we get another order for 500 after that. You use it for that. But usually holding material, managing material, stocking material is expensive. So we try to avoid it as much as possible. It doesn't seem expensive. It's, oh, it's just one reel of connectors. Well, multiply that times, you know, thousands.
Yeah, all the parts. That
yeah.
It's crazy.
Yep. It starts to get, it starts to
add up. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. We have well over, I think we're close to 100,000 unique line items in our database of material we've worked with. So you can just imagine how crazy it would get.
Yeah, if we held on to all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I tell you what I would like to do with all those parts? This is a project that I've thought about doing for years, but of course I've never had like a hobby project, like an project.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've never, of course, had the time to actually do it, is I want to create an abstract piece of art with all of the the excess parts that were just going to get thrown away.
That would be pretty neat.
Yeah.
Yo, you know what you should do? I remember when you were a kid and you would like put the glue down and then sprinkle the glitter on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, do that, but with the...
That's a lot easier than, you know, just spread out some glue and see what happens.
Yeah. That's cool. I like it.
One day. All right. Moving on, X-outs on PCB panels. What are they there for and what happens to them? I think we've touched a little bit on this on one of our episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave.
And yeah, and I think probably we didn't explain them very well. I think this question is in response to that episode. They're called X-outs because the PCB supplier will literally draw an X on the PCB.
With like a Sharpie.
Not to build it. Yeah, with a Sharpie or
some other.
Yeah, so like on like a high temp crayon, literally. It's like,
oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, because it leaves a good mark on it a lot of time. So like if it's a green board, they're just going to use like a Sharpie. If it's a black board, though, not going to see a black Sharpie.
True.
So they use some kind of like, you know, you can scrape it with your fingernail. I don't know what it is. It feels like some kind of high temp crayon or something. So an X out is when, remember I just talked about our PCB supplier struggling with a 2-ounce copper board. So that board was in like a 4-up panel. It was like a 2x2 array. And so they would send us all the panels and, you know, one or two within the array, sometimes even three, would have an X out on them. And those are same deal. We don't populate those. That we do stencil print them because it's like you're not going to mask it off. So you're going to put solder on them, but then they get recycled along with everything else because they're still really good gold in there, silver, tin, copper. There's really good stuff in there. So they get recycled. They're, you know, they pay us to take those away. It's not much. I mean, it's like more or less pays for the shipping and, you know, buy some pizza, but yeah, it's really very little, but yeah, that gets recycled and they're there because in that panel, there's still two or three good boards. So you don't want to just, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, right? So I recommend against that, newly mothered Melissa. It doesn't work. Yeah, there's police and it's a whole thing.
Well, I mean, also she won't fit down the drain. So
Good point. But yeah, that's what X-outs are. And the way we manage those is we agree ahead of time in the engineering phase, whoever's programming the machines, they'll determine a location to put a colored dot. We use a yellow colored dot. Hmm. And it's just a sticker. It's about 1/4 inch diameter. And they stick that to the board, and wherever the engineer told them to stick that sticker to the board. And then the downward looking cameras on all the machines will look for that dot. And if they see it, they'll skip it. So they won't populate it and they won't inspect it and so forth. So that's how we manage it internally. Yeah. There's some shops like ourselves that refuse to let their PCB suppliers send them X-outs. You got to pay like a premium. It depends on the shop. It's like anywhere from 20 to 30% more per PCB. And they'll pass that cost on to their customers. They'll just, you know, and you, the customer, will never have any idea that you're paying that extra 20% just so they don't have to deal with X-outs.
So the total number of, if what happened, they just have to completely rebuild the panel?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll scrap them. They'll scrap them and they'll recycle those panels that had X-outs on them. Yep. They'll never ship them. But we accept X-outs because we have a good process for managing them. And there's a little bit of cost savings there for our customers. They don't have to pay the extra cost. So, yeah. That's what we do.
And it seems less wasteful too.
That's what I like about it too. It is less wasteful.
Yeah. Okay. Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 IPC 610 specifications. What is the difference?
This could probably be a whole episode, but I included it in our grab bag because...
Because you don't want to make it a whole episode.
Well, no, I don't... Only because it would be it would have to be a whole show. The book for IPC is, you know, Moby Dick is a quicker read. you could finish, you know, all of the Harry Potter books faster than you could finish the IPC book. It is a monster.
It's like, there an IPC podcast out there yet?
I don't know. They should have one though.
Yeah.
But for all intents and purposes, like, okay, obviously you don't want to know every little difference, but you want to get a flavor for what are the differences. A lot of it has to do with like how much solder is on the solder joint, be it through hole or surface mount. It's about volume. It's about coverage. It's about wetting, like totals. So for example, is the wetting around the through hole lead 75%? Or less, then it doesn't meet class 3 because class 3 requires 100%, I believe. I don't know. I haven't memorized it, obviously. I'm not an inspection. But, you know, so there's like when you're building IPC class 1, those are generally like borderline disposable products, giveaways, toys, things that you just really don't care about the reliability of. And that's maybe like 5% of the output of the world's electronics. Mm-hmm. IPC class 2 is by far like 90% or more of what products are built to. And, you know, that's somewhere in between class 1 and class 2. Then class 3 is more like this is going into space. This is going into a human body, like a pacemaker, you know, this is, you know, going to be used for a weapon, you know, like it cannot fail. Under no circumstances may it fail. So, you know, IPC is not just how it's soldered. It's also how it's designed. So like all of the footprints have to be designed for IPC class 3. All of the routing has to meet IPC class 3. You know, so requesting an assembly house to solder the product to IPC class 3, while it can be done, that does not mean that the product itself meets IPC class 3 if the design has not been validated to meet IPC class 3. So yeah. So for example, I mean, the cost difference is literally 10x at least minimum for IPC class 3 stuff, minimum. Like I was talking to, when I was at Fuji, I was talking to a defense contractor, and they were describing this product. It was a board that was like 10 inches by 10 inches and had over 8,000 placements.
Wow.
It had, yeah. Oh yeah. It had like over 800 QFNs and it's 32 layers thick.
Whoa.
Yeah. Or 32 layer PCB. And I forget how many millimeters thick it was, but you know, it's something that a soldier wears for, I forget what he said exactly is the application, but it's, you know, they make a lot of them because they give them to each soldier in this particular regiment. And it's not the right word. If you're this particular type of soldier, you each get one of these and they sell each, they charge their customer over $50,000 per board.
Wow.
So I don't know what their customer is charging the Army or the Navy or whoever's wearing this.
Yeah, because that's just the board. That's not the final product.
Right. Yeah. So when you talk Class 3, it's a totally different game. I am totally unqualified to discuss Class 3. It's just not the world I live in at all. It's like asking, you know, a general practitioner to describe, you know, laser eye surgery. No, this, it's, you know. I might be a doctor, but I don't know how to do laser eye surgery. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Any listeners out there, if you are IPC Class 3 expert and you would like to come on the show, then let us know.
Actually, that would be a lot of fun. Please. Yeah, we could do a follow-up episode on the different classes and your experience with it. So, by all means. All right. That's enough of that,
Melissa. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Here's your favorite one. How do you stay ISO certified and what does the audit include?
It's funny. We're actually having our ISO audit today, as a matter of fact. ISO, we're not going to have a whole episode on this only because
I wanted to and Chris said no.
No, I'm again, another one where I'm just not qualified to discuss it well enough. We might be able to have like an auditor come on the show or something, maybe mm-hmm. our consultant, but there is a standard, you know, ISO 9001. I think the current standard is 2015 or 2018. I think it's 15.
15, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, you read the standard and you just comply with it. And it's vague on purpose because it doesn't necessarily apply to electronics manufacturing or plastic manufacturing, but we both use the same standard. It's just, how do you ensure quality? So it's basic stuff like, how do you make sure you don't use expired material? For example, when you buy parts, how do you validate that you're buying the correct part? How do you do your checks and balances? How do you maintain your quality? Yeah. And there's a whole process to it. We hire a consultant that helps us with it because ISO is its own language. The big joke is that you need to know how to speak ISO-nese, you know, just to play on words there, because it's like knowing its own language and how to control all that. So I don't, you know, get too heavily involved in the audits. Our president, Neil, normally handles that, along with David, previous guest of the show, David Mulheron, handles that for us. But yeah, it's best left up to consultants to guide you along the way to make sure you're staying compliant and those sorts of things. And you start to learn it. And basically what you do is, like, not everybody needs to be able to speak ISO-nese in the company, but you need to set up processes that they follow that keep you within compliance. So if you, let's say, you know, a lot of times we have to hand dispense solder paste for whatever reason. Well, we're going to take that solder paste out of a jar from the manufacturer, and we're going to put it into a dispense tube. Well, that dispense tube is just a clear plastic tube. How do we know what's inside of it after, you know, after we fill it? Well, you got to label it. So that's an example of, you know, the process is, after you fill that dispense tube, label it with the, you know, the appropriate information of what you took it from. And that way there, if let's say it's flammable, you know, mm-hmm. solder paste is not flammable, but let's say there was something flammable in it and you repackaged it into a tube. Well, you got to put on that tube, hey, this contains something flammable, yeah. for example. So you set up the processes that people follow to keep you compliant. And that's why you have a quality management team. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a fair bit of work. I'll be honest. It takes some effort, but the end result is, your customers can trust mm-hmm. that you're delivering yeah. high quality products. And then part of ISO is that you either buy from vendors that are also ISO to keep you within compliance, or you audit your vendors to make sure that it's, you know, meeting the quality standards that you need. So, like, for example, we buy injection molded parts from company for one of our customers, and they have ISO 9001:2015. So we, part of our ISO management system is we get their certificate to prove that our supplier is within compliance. And we get that, you know, each year to make sure we stay up to date with it. And customers ask us for our ISO certificates, mm-hmm. and we send that to them. And yeah, so it's a pretty complicated thing. That would, you know, we could probably have another episode on it, but we would have to have more of an expert, yeah. I think, to discuss it at length. And I would need, I don't know, some kind of like continuous drip of Red Bull to keep me awake, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean? It would be thrilling.
Thrilling.
The entire thing.
Yeah. I think we've said enough about ISO.
All right. This is a little bit more thrilling. How much smaller will resistors get? 01005. Can it get any smaller?
Yeah. So we use the phrases like 0402, 0201. These are imperial measurements. These mean 0.004 by 0.002, 0402, right? Or 01005 means 0.001 of an inch by 0.005 of an inch. It starts to get a little crazy because when you get smaller than 01005, now you start to say 00804.
Yeah. Rolls so off the tongue.
Yeah. At a certain point, everybody decided that we're just going to switch to using metric at this point because it just got too small. So they call it the 01005, they call 0402 metric. And the 00804, they call 0201 metric. And that's currently the smallest. I have some, actually.
Can you see them though?
Like, yeah. I have some pictures.
Do you have, it basically just looks like dust.
It looks like dust. Yeah. In fact, I think dust looks larger than these.
Yeah.
To be honest with you.
Not exaggerating.
Yeah, not exaggerating at all. There's got to be a way we can host some images and link to them. Remind me, Melissa. I'll get you some images. I put them on a dollar bill and I put them under a video microscope and took some screenshots just to see just how small they are compared to, you know, like the grooves in my fingerprint, like they fit in the grooves of my fingerprint. It's crazy. There's how small they are. Yeah. So I'll try to get some pictures of that.
We don't work with anything that small, at least.
We do 01005.
Yeah.
0402. Yeah. Those we do, I would say regularly, every couple of weeks, probably. Maybe every month we get an order with those. They're going to start to become pretty common, but we're fine. We're totally prepared for that. They go well. It's funny though, because I remember when I first got started in this industry, you know, I remember talking to guys and they're like, you know, they're complaining about 0603s and they're like, I'll tell you what, if the 0402 ever gets popular, I'm going to retire. And they,
And they must be long retired.
Yeah. They must be long. Cause now 0201 is like nothing. Like every single day we're doing 0201, right? So, and 010, it's like, I don't know. I think they're just grumpy. I like the challenge. I think it's fun. Contract manufacturing is more fun than building your own product, in my opinion, because you're presented with new challenges regularly and you have to figure them out all the time. You know, it can
multiple
be really frustrating
times
too.
A day in our case.
Yeah. Multiple times a day. It can be really frustrating too, but it, you know, challenges are fun. There's a reason people do puzzles and play video games, because challenges are fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm enjoying it.
I think that's all of the questions. This is more of a general section that we're going to include.
Yeah.
Is that
so
correct? Yeah.
Yeah. So Sarah also asked about scary stories that we've dealt with in manufacturing. I have loads of scary stories. Loads of just, okay, I will try to keep this under 30 minutes.
Oh, no.
Because I know you have to leave.
I only have 30 minutes, so.
We had this one customer where we were building the boards perfectly fine, had no issues, and then all of a sudden had issues, and then didn't have issues, and then had issues, and it was bridging on these BGAs, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. These were really micro BGAs. I think these were 0.4 millimeter, maybe even 0.35 millimeter BGAs. Really fine pitch. You know, these balls are tiny, super close to each other. What was happening was batch to batch, we were getting inconsistent thickness of silkscreen. And what was happening was there was silkscreen around the BGAs that were lifting the stencil off of the board and causing excess solder to be put down.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's crazy. So now whenever we get those kinds of components that are that small, we just say no silkscreen, just nowhere. So this particular customer, we actually, from now on, everything we build for them, they get no silkscreen anywhere on the board. Just does not exist. That way there, we just solve that altogether, because they do like everything they do is super fine pitch, right? Mm-hmm. So there was just, it was just easier to just scorched earth, just nuclear option, no silkscreen at all. And so no more bridging on those BGAs. That was a really confusing one. We had one customer, they had these really long, like 200 pin connectors. And we had issues with the connectors were not coplanar. That's a big fancy word. Basically, we need each of the leads to be perfectly on the same plane so that when you go to solder them, they all solder uniformly. If any of them are not coplanar, in other words, if some of the leads are bent up in the air just a little bit, they would not be soldered. Well, the manufacturer of these connectors just could not keep them consistent enough. And it's also, you get a flexing of the connector in the reflow oven that's different than the flexing of the PCB in the reflow oven. So you would just get inconsistent soldering, and sometimes it would wet, sometimes it wouldn't wet. So we said, fine, what we'll do is we'll just add, we'll overprint the solder. We'll print the solder onto the masking. So overprint, increase the volume of solder. Well, we went too far, and now we had all kinds of bridging. Mm-hmm. It took a while to find our Goldilocks solder volume on that one, but we finally did. Oh, I had this nightmare job. Nightmare. It wasn't the job. The job was fine. But there are a lot of customers like to put shields over their devices. I'm not sure what the application is for. I think they're trying to prevent like radio RF interference. So they put shields, but they don't always want to put the solder the shield from us. They want to have us put clips down, and then we'll solder the clips in place. And then when they get them, they'll do other testing and everything. And then they'll put a shield on top of it where it gets clipped in by the clips. So these shield clips, I could not get the machine to pick these parts out of the tape consistently. It just would not pick. And I, Melissa, spent easily 20 hours trying to figure out what was wrong with this, trying everything. I was here till like 2 a.m, multiple days in a row, testing this, could not figure out what was going on. I finally called the manufacturer and I said, hey, look, I need your help. I'm struggling here. Like, you know, can you put me in touch with one of your customers? I want to pick their brain about how they get the, how they're able to pick up these clips. Melissa. They get back to me the next day and they say, hey, what's the lot number on that reel? And I'm like, it's lot ABC123, whatever. And they're like, oh, we had a problem with the carrier tape shrinking around the clips.
No.
They're like, yeah, you're not the only one. Nobody can pick these parts out of the tape. Because like,
thanks, buddy. Thanks
I was like, you gotta be kidding me. I just like,
please pay me for these X number of hours that I just wasting my time.
It was awful. It was awful. But at least I was glad I wasn't going crazy, you know? And the other thing was, we had built this job on our Micronic equipment, you know, and then a few months later we go to build the job on our Fuji equipment because it was during the transition. So I thought it was something we were doing wrong on the Fuji equipment because we didn't have the problem on the Micronic equipment. Oh, I was going crazy. It was going absolutely crazy. Anyway, that's probably the scariest story I have, because that was the most painful thing I dealt with. Let's see. Oh my gosh. We had a customer send us a bunch of parts, and they told us, you know, the volumes of all the parts, you know, 500 of this, 600 of that, whatever. And we did not count the parts. We didn't have an efficient means of counting the parts. So we would go to run the job, and then we'd run out of, you know, there was like 150 unique part numbers on this build. And we'd go to run the job and we'd be like, oh, we ran out of part A. Oh, well, we don't have any more of part A, so stop running. All right. Order more of part A. All right, we can run again. Ran out of part B. Oh, we don't have any more of part B. All right, well, stop running. You know, change over, tear down, like the whole thing. We must have changed over and torn down these feeders. I kid you not, like 6 or 7 times. Until finally somebody's like, hey, can we just count every single part?
Yeah.
And it was time consuming. And we did. And it was awful. And then we bought an X-ray counter.
Is that specifically why?
That was the experience we went through that told us we can no longer trust anybody's counts. Like, we trust DigiKey's counts. We trust Mauser's counts, right? But
yeah, but they have part counters.
They have part counters. and they count the parts before they send them to us.
Yeah.
So now, from now on, we count the parts. So and if the parts are going to stock, so like if we finish running a job and we're going to put those parts back in stock, before we put those parts into a fresh kit, we count them again. So they go back on a shelf, but then when they're about to be pulled for the next kit, say 3 months later, we count them in the X-ray counter. Because we don't know when we built 500 boards and we ordered 2,000 parts, well, we should have 1,500 left, right? Well, not necessarily, because we might have, machine might have rejected a couple, blah, 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 blah. And now we only have 1,492,
mm-hmm.
right? So, yeah, so we count them before we put them back into the kit. Oh, that was such a painful experience. It was like, oh my gosh, I can't even, that work order became like a curse word. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Yeah. Oh, we had this ongoing problem with stencil apertures being too small. I think we've discussed this a little bit. This, I definitely want to have a whole episode on stencil design. We'll get Brett on the show for that. Hmm. But we were ordering stencils with apertures that were too small. And so the apertures kept getting clogged. And we didn't know that they were too small because we were trusting our vendor saying, hey, look, you should be able to print with apertures with this area ratio. We're like, fine, okay, they all meet this area ratio. And we get it, and we couldn't print. I was like, what is going on? Finally, we said, forget it. You know what? We're just gonna prove our own process for ourselves. So what we did is we, just said, okay, here's a test bed, all these different aperture sizes, what works, what doesn't work. And we found that what the vendor was telling us was far from reality. And so we changed our area ratio minimum. And we said, this is our minimum, just period. From now on, this is the lowest we'll ever allow stencil apertures to get. And ever since we did that, I can't tell you how smooth our stencil printing process has gone. But for years, we would struggle with apertures too small. And we would have all kinds of issues and couldn't get consistent prints. And it was just killing us. And just, we had so many different painful jobs trying to run and just couldn't get the solder out of the apertures. And oh yeah, that wasn't any one experience. That was like a hard lesson learned. Trust but verify, I guess you could say. Trust your vendors, but verify your vendors as well, whatever they tell you. Oh man. We had a customer who had these long connectors, through-hole connectors. And I don't know if you've ever seen, Melissa, I know you have seen, but listeners, you probably haven't seen how a PCB vendor moves their boards throughout a factory. Oftentimes they're put into these racks, and because circuit boards are rigid, they're stood kind of straight up in the air at a little bit of an angle, just a very slight angle, maybe like 15, 20 degrees, but more or less straight up in the air. Well, these super long connectors were, because they were on both sides, they were like getting intertwined with each other, even though we put like gaps between them, they were getting intertwined with each other and like ripping each other apart. So they'd get like stuck together and you'd go to, oh, it was awful. It was awful. You'd go to grab a board and it would just like tear itself and destroy the board. And you're like, oh, no, we've already put so much time and energy into this. That was not fun, but it was just as easy as just, okay, we'll increase the spacing between them. And then I think what we ended up doing is we just put them on trays. We said, forget it. They're just too fragile. We just put mm-hmm. them on, laid them flat on these trays, and we moved them around the factory in trays rather than racks. That was a fun one. We had this board from a customer that was literally impossible to depanelize. Mm-hmm. We'd never seen anything like it. There was a USB-C port on the top side hanging over the edge. Mm-hmm. And then there was like a Bluetooth module with an antenna on the opposite side hanging over the edge. And there was the waste material of the panel between the two. Mm-hmm. And there was no way to separate them. I forget what we did. I think we like Dremeled them apart or something. Gosh. I don't know what we did. I'm not sure how we ended up doing it. I know we got them apart, but then we went to our, it wasn't a customer design issue. I mean, ideally we like hanging over parts on all on the same side, but this is a regular thing. We ended up going back to our design team that makes the panels. And we said, hey, you got to put relief so that when we break these things apart, we have a relief for where they break and, cut out in the panel that we can put this USB-C port can fall into when we go to bend the waste material away. That was awful. We had these like incredibly thick PCBs that were so thick that we like could not depanelize them. So we put them in our normal panel, like not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
But these were like quarter inch thick boards. Wow. It was like absurd. And I think we did have to Dremel those. I think that was the only way we got through them, is literally Dremeling them apart. Yeah, that was awful. Depaneling. I have one here about a customer's plastic covers melting in the reflow oven, but I don't remember what that was.
This doesn't sound good.
No. I had plastic melting in the reflow oven. It was on a surface mount part, but I don't remember what it was. A plastic cover. Must have heard at the time, but I don't remember what it was. Because when we got this question, I started writing down, like each time something painful happened, I started writing them down. We had one panel design. This, again, our fault, not our customer's fault. We designed these panels in a way that they were way too flexible. It was like a 16-inch long panel. And like it was like a 5x2. So it was two rows with five boards in each row, mm-hmm. 16 inches long, right? And we only held on the short edge of those rows. So the whole rows were like diving boards. They were, they were super flexible, and they would just fall apart. You would just pick up the panels and they would just fall apart in your hands. And we had like hundreds of these panels.
Oh,
that was so painful. I think what we ended up doing is we ordered like custom tooling and we just put each panel into them and we had to process the whole order that way. Yeah. That was pretty painful. Again, self-inflicted. We had another that was self-inflicted. This one was not self-inflicted. This one was, we had a customer that had a requirement for 1.2 millimeter thick PCB, but then they ordered hybrid components that had through-hole leads that were 1.6 millimeter on both sides of the board. So you'd go to run one side and you had these through-hole components sticking through. So then you couldn't stencil print the opposite side.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a total nightmare. We were like, what? What are we going to do? How are we going to? I forget. I think I know how we build them now is we get the connectors that have the through-hole leads that are 1.2 millimeters long. They're designed for the correct thickness. Mm-hmm. I forget how we ended up processing that order at all. I have no idea how we did it. We must have, maybe we jet printed them rather than stencil printing them or something. I'm not sure. We got through it though. I remember we got through it. That was painful. What else? Oh yeah. There were these ceramic capacitors near the edge of the board. And they were, ceramic capacitors are very brittle. They're strong, but they're brittle. They can crack very easily. And they were near the edge of the board. And while we were depaneling the board, the force going into the board literally cracked those ceramic capacitors because they were so close to the edge. Yeah. That was awful. Because it was a lot of boards, it was a lot of capacitors, and we had to remove them all and solder new ones on, order new parts, and ugh, it was no fun. And yes, we have a customer that has two flavors of the board, exact same PCB, exact same SMT, except for two parts, and then exact same through hole, except for two parts. So they looked like identical, and we ended up soldering hundreds of boards. The SMT was correct, but we put the wrong through-hole parts in the board. Hundreds of boards. And they were these big, heavy, difficult to rework through-hole parts. They were not easy to pull out. And these were expensive boards, so we couldn't like scrap them and rebuild or anything. we were swimming in these boards because we built hundreds of them. This is like Confessions of Worthington.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah. That was painful. We build these boards regularly. You know what we ended up doing is we ended up telling our PCB vendor, we need half the boards built with blue solder mask and the other half built with green solder mask. And then our kits, we put green tape on the kits for the green boards and we put blue tape on the kits for the blue boards. So everything's color coded now. And that's how we easily keep everything separate and make sure that we don't put the incorrect components on anything. Cause they look identical. Like you would never notice visually that these are different boards. We were mixing them up and yeah, it made life much easier to color code. Color, by the way, pro tip, color coding, just everything, just color code it. It's so good. Everything in your life. Just color code it. Can't keep track of your kids' names? Color code them. All right. Yeah. So those are my scary stories there and grab bag. Thank you, Sarah, for your questions. Keep them coming. I know we have a few more to answer, but we want to make some dedicated episodes to them to talk about like stencils, for example. Somebody had a question about stencils. We're going to have a dedicated episode on that. Somebody asked about Rojas 3 and conflict minerals.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that'd be a real good one. So we want to get somebody from the soldering industry on for that. Yeah, somebody asked about the programming process and how we get set up for a build. We can have a dedicated episode about that. Yeah, so there's a few here that we'll follow up later and have a dedicated episode. But now it's my favorite. Is if I wasn't complaining enough or doing my confessions enough, my favorite part of the show. I am ready for it. I haven't gotten to do one in a while, Melissa.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. Probably months, actually.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
Let's talk about flying. Now, I know everybody has flying pet peeves, and this is not original. This is not an original pet peeve, you know?
But it's relatable, so that's what's important.
It's relatable.
Why people come to listen to the pet peeves.
I love efficiency.
Is it about boarding?
It's about boarding and everything. It's like, okay, I had the very last seat on the plane, the very back up against, you know, like where the flight attendants are and the bathrooms. It's on Airbus A320. And I was one of the last people to board. I thought to myself, this makes no sense. This makes no sense. This is so inefficient. But that's how they do it. And I think there's some I remember seeing some YouTube video recommended to me, and I should have watched it, about why they're boarded wrong.
Yeah.
But that's only part of my pet peeve. We may have even touched on this already.
Yeah.
I think we already had this as a pet peeve.
Yeah, we might have. I don't know if it was on the show or just us complaining to each other.
It might have been.
Yeah. But, sorry. I just wanted to add that I just saw an article that I think United is changing the way that they're boarding.
Well, that's who I flew.
I think they're changing it next or the end of this month or something, or next month.
Okay.
They're changing it so that people that are in the window seats board first.
That makes sense.
There might be other changes. But then I saw some comment that said that they actually already tried to do this, like change it to this way a while back. And then they ended up abandoning it because I think by the time that you get all of the people that have different, you know, priority boarding and all these different statuses and stuff, then it doesn't really make a difference anyways.
Boarding a plane early is not a benefit.
You're stuck on a plane.
Yeah, you're stuck in a tube.
Well, I think the only benefit is then you get to, if you have carry-on luggage, you can store it.
So, okay. This is also a problem with the fact that they should not be charging for checking your bags. That's why there's so much carry-on luggage, because nobody wants to pay to check their bags.
Yeah.
So either charge for both or charge for neither, because you're just shooting yourself in the foot. You know, that's what ends up happening. So I bring a backpack, but they don't consider that a carry-on item. So I'm never allowed to put it in the overhead bin. I have to treat it like a purse and shove it down by my feet. So then I have the seat is way too small. And I'm like, granted, I'm a typical American male size person, right? But I'm not like an especially large American male. And I'm quite uncomfortable. And I can't imagine how, you know, somebody who's over 6 feet tall and over 200 pounds, like they're going to be pretty uncomfortable. mm-hmm. sitting in these seats. And the guy next to me, he had the middle seat. So I was not about to encroach on him. But he was a big fella, and he was spilling into my seat. And then I'm in the back row, so I can't recline. And then the guy in front of me reclines. And I'm like, what what alternate universe am I in right now where, you know, I'm just in this horrible position where I have my backpack down at my feet because I'm not allowed to put it in the overhead bin because I got to save that for all the people who didn't want to pay to have their checked bags. And then I can't recline. The guy in front of me reclines. The guy next to me spilling into my seat. I was like, this is no good. This is no good. Flying. And then it's like, I think, okay, so I haven't even gotten to my pet peeve yet.
Oh, okay.
But it's all leading up to, why is there not like a prosumer version of flying? Right? So like, okay, my ticket was $800 round trip because I booked it pretty late, round trip flight to Chicago. First class, and it was like obscene. It was like $4,000 round trip or something like that. So I'm not going to pay for first class. Then business class, or whatever they call it, right? I pass those seats. They don't look any different from my seat. You know what I mean? Like, they look pretty, like, you pay a pretty hefty premium, and they did not look so much nicer for an hour-long flight that I was willing to pay the premium. There seems to be no, like, oh, you know, this is the iPhone version of flying. You know what I mean? Like, people happily pay for that iPhone. It's expensive, but it's like a prosumer device. It's like a, you know, it's not a entry-level $300 Android device. It's a $1,000, you know, iPhone device or something like that. Mm-hmm. There seems to be this chasm between economy and first class that is not being appropriately filled by business class. Because I've done the business class and I'm like, this is not worth it. There's not like priority boarding. I don't want to be on the tube. Except I want to be in this big, beautiful airport.
Except on international flights. Then business class does actually.
Oh, international flights are, even economy is nice on international flights.
It depends how long your flight is.
I will say Virgin Australia was a 16 or 17 hour flight.
Oh, yeah. I love Virgin.
But it was amazing. I was like, this is practically first class, and we were in economy.
I give you, like, so much food.
Oh. And it's good food, like, for an airline. And, like, everybody's super friendly, and there's, like, places to get up and, like, move around and hang out. Like, you don't have to stay in your seat the whole time. Mm-hmm. Virgin is amazing. Yeah. So why isn't there that kind of an airline for domestic flying? Is it just that they, like, Americans look at, like, the $260 United ticket and they see the $300 Virgin ticket and they're like, yeah, I'm not going to spend the extra $40 for a better experience, and they just can't make it work? The prosumer flying airline can't make it work in the States? I don't know. There is something weird about the economies of flying that has left this chasm, and I can't figure out what it is. It's strange. And I'm sure, yeah, I think the only way to answer that is probably some kind of, you know, some kind of an economist or a psychologist or something, somebody that explains the human condition that says, no, we don't want a prosumer airline. We want these cheap airlines that treat us horribly and make billions of dollars in profits and tell us that they have to make the seats that small because profit.
Yeah, well, I guess it just depends how much the price difference is, you know?
I guess. Must say, I think I'm just becoming an old man. I think that's what this truly is. People complain about these things. I don't think they do. I think I'm getting old.
Well, they don't have, they wouldn't even be able to pay for the prosumer version, probably, right? I don't know. Well, some of them would, but the ones that probably already can probably already fly in first class, maybe. But have you seen this mock-up design that I don't think it's a real thing, but someone has proposed that's like it's like economy seats, but they're like staggered and like with a upper level and not like an upper level of the plane, but
I have seen them.
I have seen them. The joke is that like you pay less to sit on the bottom because that's where like everyone, like you're basically behind someone's butt.
Well, okay, so maybe I'm thinking of something different because the one I've seen is they stagger the middle seat.
Oh no!
Yeah, so the middle seat is recessed a little bit, so you have room for your shoulders.
Oh no, no, this is like staggered by height.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I see.
So you have more room, but then you're under someone's butt.
But I thought that actually made a lot of sense to give the middle seat reset a little bit recessed, so then they can actually, you know, they're not jammed in between the window seat and the aisle seat. I thought that was pretty smart, but mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe in reality it doesn't actually work. Anyway, my whole pet peeve is the economies of flying for some reason don't make a prosumer level airline in the United States work. End of story.
Flying.
The crazy thing is, except for the plane itself, I love the whole flying experience. I love the beautiful airports. I love chilling out at like a cool lounge, and I love planes. I love like the science of flying, and I love being in the air and looking down and seeing everything. Like everything about flying, I really love. I look forward to driving to the airport. I get excited, and like I love everything about it. It's literally just the level of discomfort because you're crammed in too tight. You're not given any leg room or anything, you know. And I think ultimately, like what's really getting me here is, you know, the world. In the world we live in, and the economy that we crave after, has incentivized all of the decisions to lead to this. Right? There's no incentive to treat your customers more kindly and give them more room unless there's a financial benefit. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and I think at least at Worthington, the way that we operate is, you know, we do consider it important to consider the fact that a customer is in a jam and we want to help them out and we want to try to do something for them, like to get them out of this jam and get these boards built as soon as possible. You know, we don't just say, hey, what's the profit for me to do that for them?
Yeah. You know, I think we would need someone that has more knowledge about the profit margins of airlines.
Yeah, for sure. But this is why I said I think it's almost like more of a philosophical discussion at a certain point, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, somebody make a prosumer airline and let me fly it, please. Thank you.
And we'll promote it on the podcast.
Yeah, see, you're gonna get like 1,000 people.
Wow.
Fly it. 1,000 people are gonna fly your airline. I mean, come on. Recipe for success right there. And I think the other thing is certain airlines used to be a bit prosumer. Right. Mm-hmm. I remember 15 years ago, JetBlue was kind of prosumer.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah, yeah. Well, and there used to be Virgin America too.
Oh, there was? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was pretty nice.
And it was pretty nice, yeah.
And I wonder, did it just, what happened?
I'm not sure. I think it got bought by, I could be wrong here, but I want to say it got bought by Alaska.
Mm. There's not many left. In the United States, like, there's like mm-hmm. four big airlines, right? It's like United, Delta, Southwest. An American. I think that's about it.
Well, and then there's all the really horrible budget ones.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But there's no differentiation between any of them. I guess Southwest is a little bit different than the others.
Yeah, their boarding is different.
Yeah, their boarding's different. Their staff and their culture is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But you know, you blink, it, you know, squint a little bit, you can't tell the difference between Delta, United, and American. They're all mm-hmm. they're all the same. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, you got a pet peeve about flying. We'd love to hear it. Email us, contact@pickplacepodcast.com. X us.
Oh, gosh.
I'm going to let that. I'm just going to post at us. Send us a message on X at Circuit Hub or at W Assembly. And tell a friend and keep the suggestions coming. We do want to answer them all. So mm-hmm. despite the lack of answering them, this is an episode that proves we do want to answer them.
Yeah. Something I wanted to mention that I was thinking about is if you have a different preferred social media channel that mm-hmm. you like to hang out on, let us know so that we can become more active there.
Yeah. And let us know if you don't want to have us on a social media channel.
Yeah, I think that's it. Thanks for listening to the Pick Place podcast. If you like what you heard, consider following us in your favorite podcast app. And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Explore, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Chris.